Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On October 23rd, Southern California Gas Company alerted the state of California about a natural gas pipe eruption at its Aliso Canyon underground storage facility. Since then, more than 82,000 metric tons of methane gas have spewed into the air, according to the Environmental Defense Fund estimates. Also, according to the EDF, at its peak, the leak was putting out as much climate pollution as 7.5 million cars put out every day. SoCalGas has brought those emissions down by 40%, but the amount that is remaining is still massive. Experts are saying it's the worst environmental disaster in the U.S. since the BP oil spill in 2010. Thousands of residents who live in the nearby community, Porter Ranch, have evacuated their homes. Many have experienced nosebleeds, headaches, dizziness, shortness of breath, rashes, and sick pets. Last week, Governor Jerry Brown finally declared the calamity a state of emergency after ongoing pressure from residents and activists. Early attempts to stop the leak failed, and the gas company is now drilling a relief well that is expected to be ready in late February. But it could be months before the leak is plugged. So joining me today to talk about the environmental and public health implications of this leak are two guests. Timothy O'Connor is the director of Environmental Defense Fund's Oil and Gas Program in California. His work focuses on reducing pollution and supporting solutions related to heavy industry and power plants and compliance instruments and cap-and-trade programs. Tim has been monitoring and covering the ongoing methane gas leak, and he joins us from NPR West Studios in Culver City. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. We are also joined by Alexandra Nagy, Southern California organizer at the Los Angeles branch of Food and Water Watch. Alexandra works within the LA and Greater Southern California region to advocate for consumer health. She also works on a statewide ban on fracking, and she has been working with Porter Ranch residents since the methane gas eruption. And Alexandra joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Hi, Alexandra. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. We also invited SoCalGas to join us, but they did not respond to our interview requests. We did print out a response on their website, which I will read in just a couple minutes. But before I do that, finally, over the holidays, this started getting a little bit of attention, and now that it has been declared a state of emergency, and now that a lot of people have gotten sick and have been forced to evacuate, it is getting national media attention. But what we're hearing is that this is a methane gas leak without much information about what this actually means. So why don't we first talk about methane? It is the main component of natural gas. It's the main constituent in the natural gas that is often used for heating and cooking in homes. But Tim, what would you tell us about methane gas? What is it exactly?
Well, methane is a molecule, and it is really a very, very potent greenhouse gas. Compared to carbon dioxide, it is 84 times more potent at contributing to climate change over the first 20 years it's released. It's really something that scientists in recent years have uncovered as being a very significant contributor to climate change, and in fact, 25% of the warming that we're experiencing today from man-made operations is because of methane. It's something that California is dedicated to reducing, something that we've been trying to reduce leaks and methane emissions across the energy infrastructure, and really this leak is setting back a lot of those efforts that we've been engaged in for years.
What would you add to that, Alexandra? Methane is colorless and odorless.
I would add that, you know, even though methane is the largest component of natural gas, what we're also concerned about is the odorant, which is methyl mercaptan. It's what they add to the gas to give it that smell so you know when there's a leak. And that's what's causing the severe health problems in residents that by now 12,000 have had to flee their homes because they just can't get around the health systems. It's unbearable to live there now. And there are also small traces of benzene, toluene and other known carcinogens, the air district did air sampling and found that the benzene levels were higher than normal and can cause cancer in the long term, which means over lifetime exposure. And what's interesting is that these residents have been smelling this gas and have been reporting the health problems long before the gas leak happened. And I've actually been working with the community since 2014 to stop oil drilling in the area, but also to figure out what's going on. We've been, you know, noticing these smells, noticing these health problems. So this is a much bigger issue than just this one leak. And it shows how inherently risky, you know, fossil fuels are in maintaining our addiction to them, and why the community is calling for the complete shutdown of this facility.
So when methane is processed for use in homes, again, for heating and cooking, you mentioned that an odorant is added, and that is so people will be able to smell it if there is a gas leak. So you're saying that residents in this area were actually smelling something before SoCalGas alerted the state of California about this eruption?
Absolutely. This has been ongoing for years, and I even spoke with a resident, Maureen, just last weekend, who's lived there for 40 years, and she's been smelling it the entire time she's lived in the Porter Ranch area. And it just shows, I mean, when SoCalGas had this leak and the Air Quality Management District went and did an investigation and just looked at a random sample of 16 of their wells up there, they found that 15 of those wells were leaking. And so it just shows that despite all the efforts to regulate methane and despite all the efforts to curb these emissions, it's going to happen. This is just inherently risky, and the residents have been suffering from this for far too long. And it just shows that it doesn't belong next to communities, and residents want it shut down.
Well, and so what did residents do? I mean, when they started smelling this and they started to have nosebleeds and headaches and dizziness, which it got worse late last year, what can they do about this? Who do they complain to?
So when the leak first happened, it was so bad. I mean, it was obvious that something really had gone wrong, and it was more than just sort of the gas that you were smelling at night and here and there. So they called 911. I mean, they felt it was an emergency. They called 911. The fire department came out, went to the gas facility, did the inspection, and confirmed with residents right then and there that, yes, there was a leaking well. They also called the air district, so you can call 1-800-CUT-SMOG to report any kind of odor in the South Coast Air District region. So that's what residents did, and an air quality regulator came out to sample the air and also to inspect the facility and confirmed with residents again that, yes, there was a leaking well. But when residents would turn around and call the gas company and say, we're smelling this, what's going on, we know there's a leaking well, the gas company would deny it. And so there's been a lot of mistrust. We've caught the gas company lying. And it's hard. We had to put out information. We created a flyer that said, smell something, say something, call this number to report the smell. But a lot of people just really don't know who to call. And so they would call the gas company, and the gas company would say, everything's fine, nothing to worry about. And so there's been a lot of education and a campaign around getting awareness about who you're really supposed to call to hold the gas company accountable.
So, Timothy, what actually causes these leaks? And can you be specific about SoCalGas and what we're talking about right now in Southern California?
Sure. The emissions of methane really is a problem that has been noticed across the nation and really across the world. When we think about natural gas and the infrastructure that we have to use it for home heating and cooling, and really for power generation as well. In fact, a lot of the energy that is made in California is from natural gas-fired power plants. We made a decision to get off of coal a number of years ago, and really that's kind of changed the dynamic to one which is really based on a foundation of natural gas and increasingly renewables. And so as methane comes out of the ground from the places where it's produced in natural gas, a lot of places around the nation, here in the western region and also a lot on the east coast, it comes out, you know, through wells and is transported through pipes and compressed and transported across state lines and processed in various plants and then sent to our neighborhoods where it travels underneath our homes and streets and it's delivered to the points of use. And in every point along that way, along that value chain, where you have pieces of equipment that are fit together or you have individual pipes, over time, pipes corrode and things sitting in the ground or above ground, they can leak and they require regular maintenance. And so the problem that we see really across the United States is a series of pieces of infrastructure that do indeed leak methane and need constant maintenance and repair. And that's why California and the federal government and many states are working to implement new regulations to require regular inspections and leak detection and repair and preventative maintenance to prevent these things from happening. And what this facility issue tells us is that in California and at these natural gas storage facilities, which is what this is, it's really no different. The requirements over this particular facility haven't been updated in decades. And so basic minimum requirements for these wells really might or might not have been met. And I think that there's a big investigation which is looking into that. But what we do know is that even if they were met, they're very basic minimum requirements, and which don't really require the state-of-the-art best practices that the industry itself has recognized is needed. And it's really just proof positive that when we let these things leak or we let companies sort of self-regulate, they don't do as good a job as when we have comprehensive regulatory regimes. Mm. And this is the worst-case scenario of what happens.
Well, you talked about the pipes that are under our homes, and Scientific American has a piece about the methane leak, and they report that most of the methane that is used in Southern California homes actually comes from somewhere else, typically West Texas or Southern California, and it's transported, or Southern Colorado, and it's transported to California via a massive network of interstate pipelines.
Yeah, that's correct. And in fact, the science is becoming increasingly clear that in that vast pipeline network and at the points where it's produced, we have very significant emissions, more so than what people have thought was coming out previously. The Environmental Protection Agency, the US EPA, and the industry has their own estimates. And study after study shows that the amount of methane coming out of these places where it's produced and where it's transported is much higher than what people previously thought. And so, yes, we're the nation's second largest consumer of natural gas, California, and we have to import most of that gas, and we get it from pretty much all over, and, yeah, from the places you noted.
Because it doesn't smell, do we know how many leaks we're currently dealing with in California?
Well, we can look at various different parts of the chain, and there was a law that we helped to write and pass a couple years ago that is now being implemented, and it requires individual utilities in California to report how many leaks they find in their systems. And it's very interesting, once utilities start to have to report this stuff, I mean, your eyes just become totally open to the problem that we have of our aging infrastructure. For example, Southern California Gas Company reports tens of thousands of leaks throughout its transmission and distribution system, many of those leaks over 10, 15 years old. Pacific Gas and Electric, the utility to the north, the largest combined gas and electric utility in the nation, reports many, many leaks, tens of thousands, some of which are over 30 years old. It means they found a leak 30 years ago, and they've been letting it persist thus far because really the requirements have not made utilities fix leaks if they're something other than a immediately hazardous to life and health. And so we're trying to change the paradigm here in California for the underground pipes from the distribution and transmission sector, and also now from these storage facilities, of which Aliso Canyon is but one of 413 in the United States, and we think they're all at risk for these types of events.
Wow. What about that, Alexandra? The LA Weekly has been following this very closely, and they report that Sempra Energy is the parent company of Southern California Gas, and most of the wells at their fields were drilled many decades ago. In filings with the Public Utilities Commission in 2014, the company noted that 229 wells at its facilities, half were at least 57 years old. 52 of them were at least 70 years old. In 2008, the company had to do three costly workovers to repair the leaking wells. By 2013, that number had grown to 9. And so they conclude that these older wells were not built to modern standards. How is this happening? Why is this legal?
That's a really good question. And this Aliso Canyon storage facility is within an oil field. So it was an oil field that was active in the 50s and then, you know, came out of production and was no longer viable for oil production in the 70s. And then the gas company purchased that and transformed it into an underground gas storage facility. And so they took these wells that were never meant to be high intensity use, you know, the high intensity injection of gas underground, and started using them, despite the fact that they had, you know, none of these sort of safeguards that Tim has been talking about. And it's just really shown that that document that you were talking about, we've been using that in the community for a while to kind of educate folks on just how old and dangerous and leaky this facility is. And the gas company knew. They themselves admit that they've seen a negative well integrity trend at their facility, which means the age in combination with the high intensity use is causing their wells to crack at an increasing rate, putting communities in the direct path of a disaster. And really, this just shows that, I mean, if you don't, if the companies themselves aren't willing to put the safety valves in place and aren't willing to, you know, invest the money in keeping their facilities in good working condition, then why should the ratepayers be forking over millions of dollars to get these facilities back online? Why should the ratepayers, you know, be supporting this type of infrastructure when we should be putting that money into what the real transition is? And if we really wanted to change the paradigm, that would mean looking towards real, clean, renewable energy and no longer maintaining this reliance on natural gas. I mean, getting off of coal was one thing, and it's unfortunate that natural gas in the industry has been able to, you know, characterize themselves as the clean transition fuel. It's just this leak busts that myth, and the fact that they've been letting leaks go on like this throughout their transmission system is just outrageous. And so we really want to use this as an opportunity for a rallying cry once and for all to say natural gas is a bridge fuel to nowhere. We need to be investing the money not in repairing all of this, because there's just so much wrong that it's going to be impossible, but let's spend that money on the just transition to a real clean renewable future. And that's what the residents of Porter Ranch are calling for, and that's what we hope organizations join with us to call for.
Alexandra Nagy is Southern California organizer at the Los Angeles branch of Food and Water Watch. She has been working with Porter Ranch residents since the methane gas eruption, and so many families have had to evacuate. Thousands of residents have evacuated their homes. Many have experienced nosebleeds, headaches, dizziness, shortness of breath, rashes, and sick pets. We're also joined by Timothy O'Connor, director of the Environmental Defense Fund's Oil and Gas Program in California, and he's been monitoring and covering the ongoing methane gas leak. We did reach out to SoCal Gas, but we didn't hear back from them. They've got a statement from their president and CEO, Dennis Areola, and it says that our focus remains on quickly and safely stopping the leak and minimizing the impact to our neighbors in Porter Ranch. SoCal Gas reaffirms our prior commitment to mitigate the environmental impact of the actual amount of natural gas released from the leak. We look forward to working with state officials to develop a framework that will achieve this goal. Timothy, how transparent has SoCal Gas been about this leak so far?
Well, they've certainly been transparent that they've got a major environmental problem. Well, since the national attention has started to focus on it, they really can't do anything other than that. At the beginning, though, I think there was some significant downplaying of the severity of this problem. Once the states started doing airplane flyovers and measuring the concentrations of methane in the air and finding upwards of 56,000 kilograms of methane being emitted per hour, that's about, that's just so significant. I mean, 72 million standard cubic feet of natural gas per day, you know, volumes on the scale with which nobody thought was possible. They really been unable to hide, the severity of this problem. And once the infrared cameras started showing how the methane was spewing into the air like a gigantic volcano coming from the top of the mountain, right next to people's houses, really, I think that's where you saw national and international attention start to focus on this. And so now, of course, the facility is focused on getting the leak stopped, and everybody needs to be, you know, laser-like focused on how do we immediately reduce the impact of this leak on the community. They're planning the development of a new gas collection system where they're going to be collecting and likely combusting gas that's coming out. They're also pumping out the material from the facility to reduce the pressure that's underground so that they can reduce the amount of methane that's coming into the air. And with these two solutions, we think they're going to be reducing a significant amount of the pollution load into the atmosphere. But really, I mean, at this point, there is such stringent and significant oversight by the state agencies and in many ways by the national labs at the federal government that the company really can't do anything but follow the orders of the experts that are requiring them to do what they're doing.
Well, if you have any questions about what is happening in Southern California, we'd love to hear from you. Who do you think should be held accountable? Are you concerned about methane gas leaks in your area? Do you even know if they are in your area? Because a lot, I understand that, Alex, a lot of residents didn't even know the gas storage facility was so close to their home. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. And that's been kind of some of the shock and the wake-up call for a lot of these residents and just realizing how big this facility really is. It's, you know, the fifth largest storage facility like this in the country. And I think they were just really unprepared and sort of, you know, just didn't know how to deal with this, didn't know who to talk to. Like I said, they would call the gas company if they had a complaint and just get the runaround or be blatantly lied to. And now what's happened is because of this gas leak, it has to be disclosed when you buy or sell your home in the Porter Ranch area, or if you've been affected by this leak, you have to disclose that when buying and selling. And that's going to dramatically change sort of the perceptions of the Porter Ranch community and going to change the real estate market up there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that disclosure is very important, and people just didn't have that kind of information before.
Well, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Rob writes in and says, the leak started in October. Why is it only now getting attention? Why has it taken so long, Timothy?
Well, I think that folks like Alex's group and our group and many others have been talking about the importance and severity of this leak really kind of since very close to the start. And the people in Porter Ranch, of course, have been feeling the, you know, the effects of the emergency since day one. And the initial time period after it was started, I think it really didn't gain that much attention because of the fact that it was not something that people could see and touch and feel. It was more like a local problem that the international and national news was seeing, and therefore they weren't really reporting on it. But once the airplane flyovers and the emissions data, people could see the data about how humongous this was. I mean, people think of a natural gas leak, they don't think of something with global significance. They think of you know, a small natural gas leak. Maybe you smell it, it goes away, it's okay. But then once you see the pictures of it, you know, inundating the community and spewing into the air in mile long plumes, it really is just something that you can't fathom. And then once people start to realize that this is but one of 413 facilities across the United States and you know, many thousands across the world, and that it could happen in their backyard, it's really an unavoidable thing to miss.
Right. And again, it's invisible. And last month, your organization, the Environmental Defense Fund, released an aerial infrared video showing the magnitude of the natural gas leak. And then that went viral because we could actually see it. And if you're online right now, if you go to yourcallradio.org, we've got a picture of what that looks like. So, Tim, what happened? I mean, when people actually were able to see what it looked like?
Well, the outpouring of concern has been so dramatic. People from France and Russia and South America and really all over the world, Australia, have been writing to us and I'm sure reaching out to Alex and others, trying to understand what happened and why is this ongoing. I think people are just generally concerned and really raising the awareness of methane as a pollutant and oil and gas operations as a potential source of pollution if we don't, you know, treat it with the utmost rigor and care for maintaining the integrity of the pipes. And now that the governor has declared a state of emergency and we have such significant attention on it, I think that the overall awareness of oil and gas pollution has been really elevated nationally, internationally, to a point where even the the head of the Environmental Protection Agency in the federal government has, you know, said they need to double down on their efforts to reduce methane pollution. And the Obama administration and the state of California and many other states are really working to reduce methane pollution. And this is a very important data point to move those regulatory dockets along.
Well, as we said, Governor Jerry Brown finally announced a state of emergency. He also ordered new regulations, according to the LA Times, including stepped up inspections and safety measures for all natural gas storage facilities in California. They would require SoCalGas and other operators to conduct daily inspections and use infrared leak detection technologies. The question is this enough and how will this be enforced? We'll continue this discussion about the methane gas leak in Southern California on Your Call right after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. There are many ways you can take part in the conversation. On the phone, sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, please call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation about President Obama's final State of the Union address by focusing on his foreign policy. How has U.S. foreign policy changed under President Obama? And how would you describe his legacy? Watch the speech. It's tonight. We will be airing it tonight. And then you can call in tomorrow with your thoughts on foreign policy. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the methane gas leak in Southern California. Thousands of residents who live in the nearby community, Porter Ranch, have evacuated their homes. Many have experienced nosebleeds, headaches, dizziness, shortness of breath, and sick pets. At its peak, the leak was putting out as much climate pollution as 7.5 million cars put out every day. SoCalGas has brought those emissions down by 40%, but the amount is still massive. We're talking about this with Timothy O'Connor, Director of Environmental Defense Fund's Oil and Gas Program in California, Alexandra Nagy, is Southern California organizer at the Los Angeles branch of Food and Water Watch. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Denny in Richmond. Hi, Denny. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the show. Apparently, according to LA Weekly, Southern California Gas has at least 50 of these types of facilities it's operating. And as Timothy mentions, they're all over the place, and it's really a big problem. I was part of a published journal article study in environmental health last year called Warning Signs, where we studied that total infrastructure had citizens take air samples everywhere from the wellhead all the way to the gas pipeline and the waste pit, and pretty dramatic results in five states, including, in some cases, levels of pollution that were 2 million times over the EPA cancer risk level. So thanks for bringing up the infrastructure issue, Timothy, because the whole infrastructure is full of leaks, and it's more than just methane.
Well, thank you for calling in. And to add to this question, Rob writes, why hasn't this fixed? It's inexcusable that the methane has been leaking this long. Timothy, can you respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And on the infrastructure leaky issue, you know, it's really important to note that the science about natural gas that's been emerging shows that, you know, it does have a benefit when you look at the climate relevance of natural gas compared to some of the fuels that it replaces, like coal or oil or diesel fuel when you use it in vehicles. And that climate benefit, though, can be undermined, if not completely erased, if you let the methane leak into the air before it gets to the point it's, eventually going to be used. And in fact, because it's such a potent greenhouse gas, 84 times that of carbon dioxide over the first 20 years it's released, if just 1% of the methane leaks into the air, then you can completely switch the climate benefit of gas compared to some of the fuels that it replaces. And so it is just so tremendously important to keep the gas in the pipes where it belongs and not let it go into the air and really waste actually a valuable commodity. And on the second point, you know, why is this taking so long? Well, the leak itself is really, really large, as been noted. And it's quite a dangerous situation up there on the mountain. And the way that it's leaking out, although they've tried 6 or 7 times to get at the leak at the source in the pipe going through the top of the pipe, it's so voluminous that they have to drill a relief well to actually attack it from the bottom. And so much like the Deepwater Horizon that took 87 days to fix back in 2010, they're drilling a well starting about 1,200 feet away, and they're going to try to intercept SS-25, that's the leaking well, at about 8,000 feet in depth, where they're going to inject mud and cement from the bottom. Wow. At the same time, they're going to try to inject mud and cement from the top and kill it that way. It's a very complex process. They have a lot of safety concerns, and so they're doing it very, very slowly. And they think that will happen, the final kill, sometime in February.
There are also questions, Alexandra, about, you know, who should be held accountable for this. How will the gas company be held accountable?
I'd like to, make a point to what Tim said about gas being cleaner than coal, and I think that's just completely misleading because all of this gas, 90% of it in the storage facility, comes from fracking across the western United States. And we've seen that fracking, when you're using extreme technologies like fracking to extract this natural gas, it's actually dirtier than coal because of all of the methane emissions happening right there at the facility, at the sites where they're doing this fracking. And so it may be cleaner burning, but when you look at the entire process and the entire chain, gas is actually dirtier. And so really the solution is not to keep it in the pipes, but to keep it in the ground. And then to your question about, you know, who do we hold accountable and how do we hold the gas company accountable, we've had local regulators, local officials, to state officials saying the gas company needs to pick up the tab for this entire mess. The LA County Department of Public Health mandated that the gas company provide free relocation for residents that want to be relocated. And so at this point, 12,000 have left. But really, when you're talking about the cost of all these mitigation efforts, the cost of, you know, repairing these facilities to get them to, you know, a better place where they're not going to be as leaky, right? We know, as Tim said, this stuff is inherently risky, inherently dangerous. It's inherently leaking. There's not really a lot we can do about that. And it's just a really challenging question. Do ratepayers, are they going to bear the cost of this? And if so, shouldn't we talk about putting ratepayer money towards the real solution, which is getting off of natural gas altogether and going to a 100% clean energy future? And that's what we want to use this conversation to push forward. I mean, natural gas is inherently a problem across the board, and that's what's really important here.
To your point about natural gas, Henry just wrote in and wanted people to know about a recent Living on Earth show with Anthony Ingraffia, professor of engineering at Cornell and a leading expert on the natural gas infrastructure. And he makes the point that when you factor in all the leakage, the routine leaks, even before this disaster, and the fact that methane is a more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, converting from coal to natural gas is going in the wrong direction. He says we're making climate change worse, not better. But Alex, I mean, we hear in TV ads, radio ads, you name it, that natural gas is much cleaner. I mean, even the term natural gas sounds better, right?
Absolutely. And that's all industry propaganda. I mean, they have the money to put those ads on TV. They have the money to, you know, fund junk science that says it's cleaner and, you know, covers up the fact that the entire chain, especially when you include fracking, makes it a much far worse solution than coal. And I think that's where the industry has sort of fooled us all, in that saying, you know, this is the transition fuel. But in the reality, the Southern California Gas Company and their projected 22-year market demand, they want to increase the amount of natural gas that they supply California. That's not a transition fuel. A transition fuel means finding a timeline to get off of gas. And this facility, leaking the way it is, really shows the urgency of that and really points to debunk the myth that natural gas is a clean transition fuel and really calls for the urgency around getting off of natural gas as quickly as possible because it's inherently risky, it's inherently dangerous, and we can't subject our communities to this any longer. And how many more people need to be displaced before we force the gas companies to relocate or move or shut down?
Timothy, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think that Alex over at Food and Water Watch has really hit the nail on the head for a couple of the issues here. One is, when we're looking at natural gas leakage, we can't selectively choose, oh, this pipe versus that pipe. You have to look at the entirety of the system to see where it's leaking. If there's leakage coming from fracking, and there's so much evidence to show that there is, if it's coming from the transmission pipes or the processing plants or the natural gas storage fields or the things, you know, that lead into our houses, it all has to be considered. And the science shows that actually when you do add all that up, it is above generally where we think needs to be in order to make sure that natural gas provides a climate benefit. So the EPA and the state governments, they need to, you know, redouble their efforts and pass smart, comprehensive legislation and regulations to limit and reduce the amount of natural gas. Because, I mean, for better or worse, it's ingrained in our economy. It's ingrained in our energy infrastructure. And as we're thinking about and working towards other zero carbon solutions, indeed, you know, natural gas is made, you know, it's carbon. It's made from fossils. We need to figure out how to limit the impact of the current system on the environment while we're working towards the transition that Alex and many of us are really trying to focus on. And we think Aliso Canyon really raises the bar for the conversation, both on the leaks and on the transition.
Timothy O'Connor is director of the Environmental Defense Fund's oil and gas program in California, and Alexander Nagy is Southern California organizer at the Los Angeles branch of Food and Water Watch. Thank you for that email, Henry. And let's go next to David in Berkeley. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Great program thus far, and thank you, Timothy and Alex. So Timothy already started to talk about this, but so what are our remediation options? How do we fix this? Credo Mobile put out an alert yesterday asking for intervention from President Obama and EPA, but I don't see what resources they would have to bring to bear.
Timothy?
Well, I think some of this, of course, is going to be engineering focused. The abatement order from the South Coast Air Quality Management District really starts the process of getting the company to install some gas collection equipment so that while they're pumping down the amount of gas that's in the field and reducing the pressure in the subsurface and thus reducing the amount that's coming out of the well, that they're also going to be able to capture the gas and reduce how much is going to the atmosphere. Now, they've talked about combusting that gas and destroying it there. And when you combust methane, you essentially oxidize it and turn it into carbon dioxide, reducing that 84 times multiplier just down to one. But that really isn't a very, you know, promising long-term solution, of course. The only long-term solution is going to be to kill this well. Mm. And the ultimate long-term solution is going to be to figure out if this facility is needed, because certainly, as Alex at Food and Water Watch said, when the gas company or when the regulatory agency went out to the site to go look at other sources to see if there was anything else that was contributing to methane pollution and the smells, they found 15 other wells on the site that were leaking. Wow. And that is just wholly unacceptable. A company that is under the microscope for a major environmental catastrophe, then, you know, when the regulators go out there over 2 months after the start of the catastrophe, they haven't even gone and inspected the other wells at the site to make sure they're not leaking. It's just so emblematic of the problem with our natural gas infrastructure and why we need to not leave it on these facilities to regulate themselves, but why we need to put them under the microscope to make sure they're inspecting and holding these equipment to the highest maintenance and integrity standards.
What about that, Alexandra? We just got an email from Tim who says, how can we reduce the need for this facility and others like it?
Yeah, and I just wanted to add that there are other things we could be doing to mitigate this leak. One of them is exporting as much gas out of that facility as possible to completely draw it down, empty it, and you know, put less pressure in the facility so that there's less methane going into the air. And I think if the EPA were to get involved and use their emergency powers under the Clean Air Act, that could go a long way to helping and ensuring that this facility is drawn down as quickly as possible. But to the question on, you know, how do we reduce our reliance, this gas company, SoCalGas, is working on another 20-year franchise agreement with the city of Los Angeles. So they're trying to lock in a 20-year agreement to make sure that they stick around and protect their bottom line. But that is another avenue we can be working with the city to push them to come up with a plan for 100% clean energy. We're mandated by state law now to come up with a plan for 50. Let's look at the whole pie. Let's really figure it out. Let's put the best minds to it and not reward the gas company with 20-year long-term contracts. That's just totally unacceptable at this point. They shouldn't be rewarded. We should be keeping them year to year in terms of the agreements we make with them, and actively work and push our elected officials to come up with the plan for 100%. And that's what we really hope to get out of this as well, is not only stop the leak, but use this to build the political will and the momentum around holding our elected officials accountable to us, the people, and not the corporations that fund their elections or give them handouts. And that's, you know, what's really important, is being in the streets, organizing to demand the clean energy revolution that we all deserve.
Well, to your knowledge, have any Democrats in California embraced that position?
The position for 100% clean energy?
Yes.
No, not so far. Not so far. So we're working on that, and that's where the conversation really needs to go. I mean, we passed legislation around 50% with SB 350. Senate Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon was a champion behind that, by the request of his communities who have been affected on the front lines of climate change and fossil fuel infrastructure. But, I mean, we need to go 100%, and we've talked about, you know, we put out an analysis that says if we really want to do something about global warming and really looking at all the fossil fuel reserves that we have, we need to keep it all in the ground and transition to 100% as soon as 2035 to really stop the worst effects of global warming. So we're on a clock, and the clock is ticking, and we need to move quickly, and it's up to us, the people, to demand that change and to put the pressure on our politicians to listen to us and not the corporations, who, of course, don't want to go away because their bottom line and their profits will be affected.
To that point, Henry writes in, sure, SoCalGas should be punished, but let's not let Jerry Brown off the hook. As long as he allows fracking, disasters like Aliso Canyon will keep happening, and the climate catastrophe will continue to accelerate. The most positive thing that could come out of this would be for people to join the campaign to get Jerry Brown to ban fracking, as Governor Cuomo has done in New York. What about that, Timothy?
Well, I think that the disaster at Aliso Canyon was caused probably by a multitude of factors, and we're going to know shortly what the investigatory outcome is, and whether it was maintenance or oversight or inspections, and it's likely going to be, you know, something, you know, from a number of different categories. And, you know, while there has been some studies that have actually shown that the well records at Aliso Canyon show that there was likely some fracking at the site to increase gas volumes, fracking in places like the Central Valley of California and other places really probably hasn't had an impact specifically on why this facility leaked. But I do know that, you know, this facility does take in gas that comes from fracking operations, both in California and outside. Nobody knows the exact percent. But, you know, when we think about, you know, where we're going here, and one of the things that Alex really kind of talked about is this 100% renewables, you know, regardless of, you know, whether, you know, we're going to push for 100% or 50% or even, you know, 33%, the facts of the matter is that as we have built our energy infrastructure on natural gas, and as we get more and more renewables on the system, in Southern California, the intermittency of those renewables, the solar obviously doesn't, you know, generate electricity at night or when the clouds are there, or the wind doesn't generate electricity when the wind isn't blowing. And because of that, the gas companies have been very effective, and the energy companies have been very effective at essentially getting approval to build out new natural gas-fired power plants to make up that demand. Hmm. And so if we're going to actually do this, if we're going to transition to a very large percentage of renewable energy onto the grid, we need to do so in a way that it doesn't actually then build into the system, you know, more natural gas. And there's things like energy storage, electric energy storage, demand response programs, energy efficiency that can reduce the peak amount of electricity we use, the peak amount of gas that we use, and the gas that we need, so that as we're doing these, we're not requiring more Aliso cannons to be built. And so we need to pursue that pathway that Alex is talking about very thoughtfully and really with the attention to the new energy system that we want to cultivate. Because if we just continue with the status quo, I think we're going to get more of these facilities and not less.
Alex, do you want to jump in there?
Oh, I completely agree. We need to be extremely thoughtful. And the last thing we want is for our, you know, efforts to go renewable to bring more natural gas fire power plant, peaker plants online. And so we look forward to having these conversations. And this is, you know, really opening the door and creating the impetus to have that conversation publicly and openly. And that's what's really exciting about this terrible disaster is that, you know, now people are going to be willing to come to the table to really figure this out. And we're looking forward to working with folks on that.
We have time for a few more calls and emails. Let's go to Aaron in Oakland. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just want to pursue this this thread of holding our public officials, our elected officials, accountable on all this. It's really important that we face how deeply entwined with our elected officials the fossil fuel industry is. And Dr. Sandra Steingraber has recently put out an article after the Paris conference that discusses Jerry Brown. And I'm sorry to report, it gives me no pleasure to share with you that Sandra Steingraber is reporting that Jerry Brown's own sister is a highly paid director at the company where the gas leak is in Porter Valley. So, you know, there's just that we have to really help Governor Brown disentangle himself from the fossil fuel industry if we're going to get any genuine solutions, I think.
Well, thank you, Aaron. When you called, we wanted to look this up, and we found a piece in Daily News that looks at Jerry Brown's sister, who's a paid board member of SoCalGas. And according to this piece, watchdog groups and the governor's aides disagree over whether that makes a conflict of interest for the governor. Alexandra, what are your thoughts on this?
I mean, I think it had an impact. There was a report by the Public Accountability Institute which unveiled that connection between Kathleen and her brother Jerry that said, you know, that these relationships are likely to have an impact. And I think it's what led him to taking so long, 75 days, to declare a state of emergency. And we were calling on him. We organized call-ins to his office, emails, the works, talked to all of his, you know, the folks in his administration, where's Jerry, and he wasn't anywhere to be found, and he literally told us, I don't think a state of emergency is required at this point of time, and we didn't give up. We pushed him to declare that, and I think it's the first time our movement, and I'm speaking of, like, the anti-fracking movement in California, anti-urban oil drilling movement, the first time we've actually pushed Jerry Brown to do anything. I mean, he purports himself as a climate leader, but yet he's expanded fracking in the state. Greenhouse gases have gone up during his administration. And we know that WSPA, which is the Western States Petroleum Administration, is the largest lobby in California, one of the largest contributors to Jerry Brown's campaigns. And just in my dealings with local organizing with communities across the state, he's personally intervened several times in communities that have passed local oil and gas moratoriums, you know, to overturn them. And so he's had a really strong hand in doing the oil industry's dirty business. And this is no exception. And so I think it's incredible that we pushed Jerry, but we need to keep pushing him to use his executive authority to shut this facility down and then to stand up to big oil and gas once and for all and do what's really necessary and, you know, not permit any more wells in this state. I mean, the industry is expanding right now at a time when we should be rapidly decreasing our oil production and shutting it all down, but he's letting it, you know, go on. And so I thank the caller for bringing that up, and I'm just really disappointed in our governor.
Well, I know that you and so many activists want these wells shut down. Jerry Brown, when he announced this emergency state of emergency, he also announced these emergency regulations that would require SoCalGas and other operators of gas storage facilities to do things like conduct daily inspections, use infrared leak detection technology, regularly test safety valves. What do you think about that, Alexandra?
I think that's really important. I think understanding the reality that our communities are facing across the state is necessary just for public health and to be able to make the right decisions about how to move forward. I look forward to those reports. I hope that, you know, there continues to be accountability and transparency on the information that comes out, and I hope it leads to, you know, a robust conversation about just how aging and old all of our infrastructure is and pushes the needle on talking about phasing that type of infrastructure out. So I think it was a good first step, but does it cover, you know, everything? No.
And I just want to spend one more minute on the health impacts, because residents were calling for a health impact study last August. And so a lot of people have left their homes, horrible nosebleeds, headaches, their pets are sick. I mean, it really ruined their holiday. So what are you hearing from people, and what do we know about long-term health impacts?
Well, we don't know much. We know that the mercaptan, which is the odorant added to the gas to give it its smell, there are no studies that are about long-term exposure. So Porter Ranch residents are sadly feeling like they're the study, you know, and that's no position that we want to be in. And we've also seen that there are, you know, higher levels of benzene that then would be desired, benzene levels that could cause, you know, cancer in the long term. And so there are so many issues. And, you know, my friends and the people I've been organizing with, they've been getting nosebleeds. They've had to go to urgent care because they literally can't breathe. They've been getting blurry vision, burning eyes. One of my friends, she can't even see really out of her left eye right now. My other friend, his son and daughter have been getting rashes all over their bodies, nosebleeds. And this is just terrible. And that's what led to the relocation of the two primary schools out in the Porter Ranch community. Parents were so concerned that the teachers themselves were getting so sick, they couldn't even teach class. The kids couldn't pay attention in class. And so getting those schools relocated was a huge effort, you know, to organize for that, and we won that, so that was great. But, you know, the health impacts are just really unknown. We don't know what the long-term impacts are because, frankly, there aren't any long-term studies for this type of exposure. And the air monitoring that's been going on so far has just only been looking at a small spectrum of the chemicals that could be in the air and causing harm to the community. So we need way more robust monitoring. We hope that the air district this Saturday forces SoCalGas to pay for a health impact assessment, which would be coupled with more robust air monitoring data to really figure out what's going on and what residents have been exposed to and what the long-term health risks really are.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this. Alexandra Nagy is the Southern California organizer at the Los Angeles branch of Food and Water Watch. Timothy O'Connor is the director of the Environmental Defense Fund's oil and gas program in California. Thank you both for your work on this issue, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about President Obama's final State of the Union address by focusing on his foreign policy. We'll talk about relations with Cuba, Iran's nuclear deal, the rise of ISIS, the U.S. military in the Middle East, the drone program, and the military budget. How has U.S. foreign policy changed under President Obama, and how would you describe his legacy? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.